gonna have roll call. Crystal Alexander.
Present.
Laura Baker Morse.
Here.
Fred Benton Jr. Paula Brown.
Here.
Ronald Burkett.
Here.
Carl DeFranco.
Here.
Gary Dunn.
Here, sir.
Robert Fregali. Kathleen Hamm.
Here.
Aaron Montz.
Present.
Jeff Rezabak. Larry Sims.
Here.
Ken Spanico. Cecil Thomas. Gary Moore.
Yeah.
Kevin Miller.
Present.
Harvey Reed.
Here.
Tim Young.
Here.
Jill Beeler.
Here.
Doug Berman. Lori Chris.
Here.
Beth Swalina.
Here.
Paul Dobson.
Here.
Steve Gray.
Here.
Jim Lawrence. John Lights. Brian Martin.
Here.
Cynthia Mosser.
Here.
Carlton Moore. Paul Pfeiffer.
Here.
David Pickett.
Here.
Keith Spate.
Present.
Julie Spahn.
Here.
Carrie Williams.
Here.
And I also noticed that, all right. We'd like to have an approval of the minutes from the March meeting. Can I have a motion?
So moved.
Crystal, second. Reed. Any changes? All those in favor say aye. Opposed, same sign. All right. This year, we're trying something a little bit different. We've had an opportunity to have some of our agencies that deal with criminal sentencing and juvenile matters come to us with a desire to speak about some of the budgetary concerns that they're presenting to the legislature, as well as outline some of the issues that their agencies are facing. And we thought it would be a great idea to have some of those presentations here today. So we're going to start with Tracy Plouffe, who's the Director of the Department of Mental Health and Addiction, and we've asked her to present.
Do you want me to stand here, or what's your program?
Yes, please, at the podium.
Good morning, everyone. This is a little bit of an awkward room presentation, but I just wanted to share with you a few updates from the department as it relates to criminal justice items generally, the budget being one of them. First of all, I just wanted to note that we're coming up on our two-year anniversary of our partnership with the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. In the governor's last budget, we took the staff who are providing addiction recovery services in the prisons and made them part of our table of organization. And working with Gary through this process, we were actually able to increase by 50%, or approximately 60 employees, the number of addiction treatment professionals in the prisons. We were also able to redirect some general revenue funds to put more resources in the community so that as individuals undertake treatment in the prisons and are released to the community, they are able to connect with short-term recovery housing, peer support, some employment coaching, some things that really help to prevent relapse and, you know, get them hopefully on a sustained path in the community to further avoid recidivism. So that is part of our budget plan that is before the legislature right now. We're proposing to continue that effort, and just wanted to note that first and foremost. In terms of our department's budget, I am passing around, or there are being passed around two documents. I would call your attention to the one that's multiple pages of PowerPoint format. That is the briefing that we used for our stakeholders on the governor's as introduced appropriation levels and policies for the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I'm not going to go through that in detail, but you can have that as a reference. What I would like to call your attention to are just four quick changes that we are proposing within the budget Generally speaking, the governor proposed consistent appropriation levels relative to this current biennium for our department and continuing all current investments. We are seeking to augment a couple of areas, four to be exact. Number one, more naloxone first responders. We have $500,000 per year now committed to connecting first responders through each county with naloxone, which is a life-saving measure for opiate overdose. We're proposing to go from $500,000 to $750,000 per year for that effort. We are proposing to expand our partnerships with our ABIS boards and county jails to serve more communities. We currently have a $3 million investment here. We're proposing to move to $4 million. We're working in with 22 projects in 38 counties currently, so we're hoping we would be able to expand maybe 8 to 10 additional counties with that extra $1 million. That can be used for treatment in the jail for mental health and or addiction. It can also be used for diversion programming or some linkage upon release. And it's identified by the community what their gap is and what they would like to address with these dollars. The third one is related to workforce. We are proposing in the executive version $3 million to help support our providers around the state partner on recruitment retention efforts for non-prescribing clinical staff. So counselors, social workers, therapists, the folks who actually provide a lot of the day-to-day, week-to-week treatment in concert with the prescriber within an organization. These dollars will be used for recruitment strategies like tuition loan repayment. It could also be used to cover the cost of supervision if you have a licensed social worker who's seeking to become a licensed independent social worker. There is about 150 hours of staff supervision time that has to be dedicated to that individual over a two-year period. So what we're proposing to do is actually fund the provider organization to cover those costs so that they don't have to choose between billing and receiving revenue for clinical hours or supervising some of their staff. So, hopefully this will provide the providers with more agility in that regard. And then the fourth item actually has nothing to do with criminal justice, but I will just mention it briefly, and that is increase our grant making to counties for children, adolescents who have emotional disorders or intellectual disabilities, and as a result, they're at risk to themselves or their families. The governor initiated a program called Strong Family Safe Communities about 4 years ago, and we're seeking to increase funding levels from $3 million a year to $4 million a year for that effort. So that's used for things like mobile crisis, respite services, things that Medicaid generally doesn't cover but are helpful in stabilizing a family situation. So that was the executive budget. The House passed version of the budget actually infuses additional resources to mental health and addiction, generally speaking. Some of that's appropriated to our department, some of that is appropriated to Job and Family Services or the Attorney General's Office or other agencies that in some way touch particularly the opiate epidemic. So we're waiting to see what the Senate does with that amount, which equated to about between 50 and 60 million in GRF per year, and then some non-GRF resources to add up to about 170 million across the biennium. So the Senate's currently, contemplating what they're going to do, and we'll probably land somewhere between the executive and the House, but we'll see what happens. As far as additional funds, though, Ohio is actually going to be receiving this month, we're actually going to controlling board on Monday, resources from the federal 21st Century Cures Act. And I would draw your attention to the map that is in your place now. President Obama last December signed into law the Cures Act, which provides about $500 million to states for immediately actionable items related to the opiate epidemic. States are in different places with respect to challenge in this area, and funding varies widely, across the states. So there's quite a bit of agility with these resources. Projects have to be initiated by September of this year, and there were some parameters like 20% to each state needed to be used for prevention and up to 80% for treatment and recovery supports. So the map that you have here indicates two tiers of counties, the yellow being the highest tier in terms of impact of unintentional opiate overdose deaths, or actually overdose deaths generally over a 5-year period, and also the presence of fentanyl as a factor in those deaths. Those communities, both the yellow and the red, will be receiving some explicit resources for some capacity expansion, and we're going to controlling board for that on Monday. That equates to about $15 million across those counties. The rest of the resources that are coming to Ohio, we're going to invest in statewide prevention initiatives. We're going to do a statewide drug take-back effort that will partner us with local law enforcement for more collection and disposal. We are going to do more screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment for primary care and other healthcare settings. And then we're also going to be working with prescribers across the state in, you know, general primary care practices, OBGYN, psychiatry, other practices to help educate people on medication-assisted treatment, because we know that the rates of relapse are lower and the overall trajectory toward recovery is smoother based on evidence related to MAT or medication-assisted treatment. So just an FYI, if you are living in or operating organizations in any of those counties, there are some resources. Some of them are explicitly related to criminal justice. I think that there are 11 counties that have requested to infuse some resources in that way, in some way, shape, or form. So that work will be underway as soon as we hopefully achieve appropriation authority on Monday. Also, we continue to be involved with the Stepping Up initiative, which is related to mental health in the jails. Julie Spohn is here from our office, and she is our coordinator for that, as well as the coordinator for the our overall interface with the drug courts and certified specialty dockets. We also continue to work with NeoMed up in northeastern Ohio to make available sequential intercept mapping for communities to look at the intersection of criminal justice and mental health and now addiction on how processes can be improved locally in order to increase time to treatment, reduce recidivism, et cetera, based on the community's needs. So that's a very quick flyby of things that are happening related to funding in our world as it relates to criminal justice. And I don't know, do you want to take questions now or do you want to go through all the presenters? I'm not sure what your
questions
are. Okay. So I just threw quite a few things at you, but I'm happy to entertain any questions or comments that you have. Lori.
Are the plans for the counties available on the website yet, or do you know when they will be?
That's a good question. We issued the award letters to counties last week, I believe, and we gave them through May 26th to modify within the bottom line what their proposed approach would be. Since they submitted earlier this spring, you know, what they intended to do and at what funding levels, I know that some, I can think of at least two offhand that have kind of changed based on some evolution within that community. So we're giving them a couple of weeks. And so I would imagine early June we'd be able to say, you know, these are the plans.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, thanks for your time this morning.
Next, we're pleased to have Tim Young, our state public defender.
Let me start with just a very brief background of how indigent defense is provided in Ohio, because you need to understand that to understand our budget. Counties are responsible for choosing the delivery model and how much they spend. So a county, Franklin County, chose to set up a public defender office, and the other counties choose to set up purely appointed counsel systems, a handful use not-for-profit systems. The state in 1976 promised to reimburse 50% of whatever county spent on indigent defense. The next year they said, well, maybe not so much. And they said, we'll reimburse up to 50%. They've never achieved 50% since then, remained very close until the late 90s, where it started to fall off a cliff and the state started balancing part of its budget by reducing the amount it was reimbursing. It dropped to a low of 25% reimbursement in 2008. It got to a high of 48% at the beginning of this biennium, and we're back down to 40% now. So my budget, the budget for indigent defense, honestly, it has two major components. The reimbursement component, that subsidy budget that we pay the counties back with, reimburse them, and then the operating budget of my office. And I want to take on both of those issues because they're both dramatically underfunded, and I don't use that word lightly. In 2006, the Supreme Court put together a pro se task force on, for pro se and indigent defense, came together with a report and recommended that the funding at that point for indigent defense in Ohio, county dollars and state dollars, all in, the operating budget of my office, all the county, all the reimbursement money, should be about $148 million. That was in 2006. The actual expenditures today, 11 years after that report, are a little under $140 million. So we're $7 million below, $8 million below that number today. Inflationary rates from 2006, if you just took that number straight inflation, didn't account for the caseload increase, the prison population increase, anything else we're seeing. If you didn't increase anything, we should be at $177 million today, all in. So today, indigent defense is underfunded by well over $35 million, minimum. That's the best estimate we have. What that leads to are huge consequences for over-incarceration, wrongful convictions, innocent people spending time, excessive sentences, because they don't have lawyers, or they don't have lawyers at all, or they have lawyers who simply aren't funded enough to represent these people adequately. We have counties with 30-year-old rate systems. When I say 30 years old, I don't mean 30-year-old, they just haven't done anything but adjust for inflation. I mean, they haven't done anything. They're paying what they paid 30 years ago to lawyers. We have other counties that have changed their rate system but not changed their caps. You can earn up to $1,000 to do a felony trial at the rate of $50 or $60 an hour. To do a felony trial. On average, that's probably well below if you actually put in the time, put in the hours you need to do a jury trial, even for a small F5, low-level felony, you're probably earning well below minimum wage at the end of the day in terms of the number of hours. And in fact, you're probably paying to cover your own expenses. You're not covering your basic office expenses if you work in private practice as appointed counsel in many of these counties. And this is not a rare county I'm pointing out. They're just the worst. Most counties have rate systems that are 15 to 20 years old. And the other piece that's going on here, because, and I have some, please don't hear me just bashing on the counties, I have great sympathy for them, because the state, every time it doesn't fund 50%, you're asking the counties to increase funding to simply cover the difference. And so the counties are incredibly hesitant to add more money into these budgets, because as soon as the state backs out of reimbursement, they're now on the hook for even more. So if you ask them to raise their rates, or you ask them to improve their public defender office by hiring more people or improving salaries, they're on the hook for, this year, an additional 8% as reimbursement had to be reduced twice. With that, that's the county system. In many respects, even worse is the operating budget of the Office of the Public Defender. In the last 17 years, we've had to go through two major layoffs, and otherwise, we've only balanced our budget through attrition. In the one-page handout you've got, very briefly, our budget was $9.5 million for operating budget of the main office, the public defender office, $9.5 million in the year 2000. 17 years later, we're at $10.5 million. That number should be well over $13 million if just adjusted for inflation. Ignoring caseload increases, prison population increases, and all the other demands that now go into indigent defense that have done nothing but increase during that period of time. All of this has gone up. In 2002, they had to lay off a significant number of staff, and just this biennium, we had to eliminate 10 positions in our office to make our budget balance. We also, during that same period of time, we also simply don't replace positions. Since 2000, we are down a third of our staff. Literally a third less people working at the State Public Defender Office today than there were in 2000, simply due to budgetary insufficiencies. That means, at this point, we're making horrible decisions. I mean, just horrible decisions. We don't represent anybody in prison who wants to post-conviction relief unless they've got at least 5 years left on their sentence. We don't have the staff. We literally write them back a letter, sorry, can't help you. Even if you have a great case,
We don't touch anybody with jail time credit issues unless they're asking for more than 90 days because we don't have the staff. Now, that's not to say we're not accomplishing thousands and thousands of days of jail time credit every year in terms of trying to reduce the prison population, get people that are to serve only the time they were actually sentenced to, but this is a dramatic problem across Ohio. There are thousands of people in the institutions today serving longer than they're supposed to simply because nobody calculated how much credit they were supposed to get pretrial before they actually got sentenced to shit. That just shouldn't be happening. And we don't have the staff to fix it. I stand here today telling you we are not anywhere close to meeting our minimum statutory duties. You look at the statutory duties that are assigned to the public defender office, we're not close. We can't be. We simply don't have the staff. It's not possible. The executive budget, and I worked closely with Tim Keene after the last budget went through, and the executive budget hurt us and attempted to help us when it was introduced. However, it was wildly optimistic about some revenues. All of this funding that I'm talking about has two main sources. You have general revenue funds, but the bulk of it is actually user fees. We're doing this on the backs of people in poverty that we represent. Most of this is coming from fines, bail surcharges, those kinds of fees that are coming in. Surcharges every time you get a traffic ticket, part of it comes into the office for distribution out to the counties, and a small piece of it stays for operating. So most of this is based upon that rotary fund of user fees. The governor's office was really optimistic about how much that was going to generate each month, and proposed a budget for us of about $12.6 million, so a fairly significant increase. Not enough, but a significant increase. The reality, however, is because of that declining revenue source, they calculated it at $3.3 million a month. It's actually generating much closer to $3.1 million a month. You do the math on that, and the reality is we're still $1 million underfunded because of that shortfall. The House, and to the House members here, thank you, heard us again and added $500,000 in general revenue funds into the budget. That gets us part of the way back to what the governor intended. So $500,000 each year of the biennium, $1 million total, and thank you. It was really well needed. Another significant piece that the House added was to add the law back in that this is no longer an up to 50% system, this is a guaranteed 50% system. A significant change that promises to pay counties 50%, which would, as I said earlier, allow us huge impact in asking and working with counties for improvement, knowing they were going to get their 50% back. They're much more likely to actually make those improvements. They have much more budget security. Future planning is much more possible when they know what's going to come back in rather than this fluctuating amount. One of the problems, however, is the House didn't actually fund 50%. They're about $6 million short on our best estimate. And because of some other changes that we know are coming through the system in the death penalty arena, we actually estimate it may be closer to $8 million short of that 50%. I don't think that's a reason to take the 50% out. I think it's a reason to add $8 million in and make this budget whole, at least for the counties. Add another million to our operating budget, and you've made a first good step, just a first step towards moving in the right direction. What this system really needs is about $30 million. And that's not buying a Cadillac of a system. That's buying a basic functional indigent defense system in the state. You've got public defender offices that haven't had raises in years, that have been flat funded for years, that literally have $0 for training in their budgets, $0 for experts in their budgets. They don't have this money in their budgets. It doesn't exist. When they need an expert, they have to go ask the judge, or they just don't ask. And training, they rely upon whatever's free. And that's not the way you build an adversarial system. It's just not. And as a result, I stand here with this sad story, asking you individually, and I'm not asking the Sentencing Commission to officially support our request, but individually, as you have conversations with legislators and those who can make this move, please don't forget us. We're a small piece of the entire budget, and I know $30 million is a lot of money. In the scheme of a $60 billion system, you can't draw the line thin enough on the pie chart for what it would take to simply fix our system. And I promise, I'd go away for a long time if somebody wrote a check for $30 billion. So, any questions?
Thank you.
on to the Senate.
We've got amendments already drafted.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
To address your issues.
Thank you, Tim. Next, we're going to have our Director of Department of Youth Services, Harvey Reed.
Good morning, everyone. My approach will be a whole lot different. The two key words you have to remember is flat and flatter. Going into this budget cycle, we were very optimistic about our request. Having had closures over the last couple of biennials that really allowed us to do some very creative and innovative things, we went into this budget cycle knowing we would not have that cover. The first thing that was on my mind was that making sure we did not have layoffs and making sure that the investments that we made in the community were what we needed to make sure stayed intact. As a result, we came out okay, but there are some missing pieces to the puzzle. Our biggest thing here for people to recognize is that the cuts that are now going in for our reclaim money, which is our community money, present a significant problem for us. And we are hoping that some of that money is restored back to its original level, because where the big picture part of this is that as we decrease money going into the community, that takes away options for the locals, which means more youth will come to DYS. We don't have the capacity for a bunch of kids to come to this age. So I just don't know. We're talking about long term having to build beds, and that is far more costly than the investment of continuing in the community, where it has been proven that the closer kids are to home, to family, to friends, to their relationships, the better chance they have for success. And that's really where we are. Our education funding, we have had a request in to kind of shore it up. One of the direct or indirect results of our education is that more and more of our kids are achieving high school diplomas and GEDs. But the adverse part of that is that we lose our reimbursement on education dollars. So we have to move money around to cover it, and it creates shortages elsewhere. We also are increasingly having our young men and women going to take on college courses while they're with us. And if you can imagine being the first person in your family who's ever had the opportunity not even to go to college, but to take a college course, this is a big deal for them. They're also gearing up in our career tech and vocational tech areas, because for most of our youth, those are the kinds of jobs that they can attain. And as we know, they pay fairly well. And with the options now of kids going out with several certifications, it allows them to get employment before they leave. We've been pretty successful at setting young men up for jobs before they go out the door, which is the key to success. But my big focus for me is education, because that's the one thing the kids earn, that's the one gift of a lifetime that nobody can ever take away from them. No matter what happens in the future, they will have that. Be it that diploma, the GED, those college courses, no one can take that away from them. That is our big push. But to give you some numbers, in 2010, we had 6 state facilities. In 2016, we have 3. Our population in 2010 was 1,125. Our average daily population now is 500. During that same time, we had about 750 youth on parole. We now have roughly 300 on parole, because that pool is shrunk, because the capacity in the community is being built. And there are a lot of judges now who take chances on young people committing felonies because they have ability to treat them locally at home without sending them to us. And that is really significant for what we're trying to do. This budget could result in us having to make some decisions that are not necessary. I think when we finally get shored up, we have to make sure that first and foremost, the result of all this hard work has been the investment in the community. There is no denying that. There's no magical thing about any director before me, it's would not me. Those investments and the relationship that has been built over time with judges, the community, our advocates, our stakeholders, to support us in increasingly doing things in the community that were never done before. Because everyone doesn't have to come to us to get their treatment. If it's available in the community and we can make sure that that happens, that's what we need to do. But when we take away options from people, that becomes a real big deal, and it's really impactful. I already struggle with working with our population that has adult time sitting on the shelf, making sure as much and as often as possible they are encouraged to get involved in as many positive things as they can, so that that option doesn't have to become a reality. They have an opportunity to change. And we have a lot of programming now that is very helpful, but it could not be done without that community cooperation. It just would not make a good marriage for us right now. You know, we do understand business. We have been, I think, as an agency, very good stewards of state money. With our closures, we turned money back in. So it wasn't like we just went out and just bought a bunch of junk. We made increased investments in the community to allow that pipeline to close. Because I don't feel any person should have to go to jail to get an education. I don't think that we have to send someone to us for a long-term stay to get treatment. Most of our youth, we have not been hit with the surge of the opioid epidemic, but we do still continue to have most of our kids are medicating themselves with marijuana and alcohol. They have a family member that is involved or know someone that's part of the crisis. I would say at any given time, 20% of our youth have a family member that is incarcerated or has been incarcerated. We have our younger females. I would say 95% of them have a mental health diagnosis and or is getting mental health treatment and is on a mental health caseload. At any given time, 50% of our youth are getting special care. Our average length of stay is 13.1 months. So when you come in the door, the educational deficiencies, treatment that needs to take place, family engagement that needs to happen, and just the overall quality of improvement, 13.1 months is not a great deal of time. So we have to hit the ground running when kids come in the door, get them ready as quickly as possible, have a destination for them to go outside the door, because we can't wait till people like, oh, it's 30 days, you're going home. We have to start when they get there. We have to have a place for them to land that's permanent. We've also started an investment in housing, where we have part of a cooperative, because we have young people that we send them back home knowing good and damn well that's not the place they should go. And we have to stop this craziness of setting people up for failure. So placing them in independent living where there's a case manager in the building that helps them with life skills and how to pay bills. Everybody wants a fab crib to live in and a nice car, but they don't know anything about paying gas and electric bills. And they have no idea. And they just think, oh, you live in an apartment, everything comes with it. No, it does. And it just teaching those kinds of skills, because most of us assume we got proper parentage. We do, but these kids are, most of them have raised themselves. And that's why we don't rehabilitate, we rehabilitate, because most of the youth we did, they never knew anything before they got here. And it's sad. It is very sad. And at any given time, 15% of our young men are fathers themselves. So we're offering parenting classes and things of those natures to help them understand the immense responsibility that they have going back into the community, because it's not just for them, it's for that young person who's not following the path. And the best way for us to do that is to continue those investments that have worked, keep our facilities vibrant, and keep them moving forward. It's not a big lift, but it's something that I feel is really necessary for our success. Questions?
Director? I understand that the last budget, there was a shall transfer monies from the Department of Education for GPDs that got changed to May in this budget, so that it's now optional for the Department of Education to transfer those monies. I also understand that the governor, you, Director Moore, are all in favor of general improvements in the program. So can you tell me why that was changed? Like why the reduction in will or whatever it is to forward that money from the State Department of Education to corrections?
be a DYSR of years.
I just think that they have a business decision to make, and that's how they make it. We continue, though, to work with the Department of Education, and they provide us with other dollars to kind of help us with that. So there are some other technical things that they do help us out with. You know, people are faced with making business decisions. Some of that comes, you know, they get passed through money from the feds, and sometimes those things change. And their priorities of who needs help, when and where, change also. So my thing is that I don't worry about it. Whatever budget I get, I'm going to make it work because it has to. And luckily, I have the ability to move money around and cover the things that are most important. And the educational piece, we will always somehow find the money to do it. My bigger concern still is I can't have 50, 60, 100 more kids come to DYS in a year because I don't have a business case. I don't have the capacity to do it. And that impact kind of is counter to everything that's been done to get me to come back. And right now, I think we are at a sweet spot. I don't think it can go much lower as far as the number of kids that we have facilities. But the majority of our kids are coming in, they're 16 and 17 years old. So if we are purposeful, we can make those education dollars work for them because they only have a short duration of time. The problem is many of them are so far behind, and that's where the GED option comes. Because I think realistically, if a kid goes out to do it 19, or so, if a man goes out to do it 19 or 20, they're not going back to their home school, even though they don't realize that up to age 22, they're required to be an educator. But it just isn't going to fit.
Well, that has ripple effects for community facilities too, because at least halfway houses would benefit from those GED reimbursement dollars as well. And now it's looking like, because of the change in priorities, that funding will also go away for our clients.
We'll gladly join you in a meeting to discuss with them how they should get their money back to us and give them what we know we have to do. Again, education is the one thing that sustains people from before a lifetime. And we talk about our kids being in poverty, but the greatest way to get out of poverty is education and a job. That's really good. When you're dealing with damaged goods from day one, you gotta make up the time as quickly as you can to live as much as you can. And that's really the focus. You're getting some of the people, even employees, to make a good time. Because the bottom line is, what would you do if your kid was at DYS? You sure as hell would be in like that a whole lot more than you are now. Because it becomes personal out there. And that's the way we have to do it. I don't know if you can look at it.
Director, what's the bottom line? Where are you at?
In fiscal year 18, my hit would be $3.2 million. In 19, it would be 3.4.
Your what?
Our cut would be 3.2.
So 3. What's that?
Roughly $6.5-7 million, depending on how it falls.
Less than present.
That, correct.
Below what the vision.
Right.
So what does that mean?
It means that we're emptying out the couch cushions, we're delaying things like purchasing automobiles for fleets and things of that nature to keep cars longer or different things just to make sure we have the ability to fund the things that are necessary.
That's department-wide, your cuttings, or?
That's department-wide.
So what about reclaim?
There's some cuts earmarked for reclaim, and that's where my concern is that if nothing else, that reclaim should stay unfazed and funded at its present level. That's really what the fight is. Everything else, you know, through attrition, I can make up staff. I can reorganize and move people around and cover. But when you're talking about dollars that go to someone else in order to keep bodies from coming to us, to me, that is very important. That is most important because we need that balance. And I think judges need a tool to use on people coming before them, bring in options and doing it, because most of our judges, they know families. They know who so-and-so's uncle is. Fred's your father, they know the whole family dynamic. They know what can work and be effective in that community. And we should only get those kids that are the most in need, that have all the deficiencies in education and criminal history, and kids who missed out on treatment. It is not unfathomable for us to get a person that a court may have spent $1 million on from the time they were 12 till they had to send them to us when they're 17. But that drain could have been a whole lot worse had those options not been in the community. And that is my foremost concern.
Director, just to clarify, what I understand, DYS has a number of versions of Reclaim, and you all do a wonderful job with all of those. There's Reclaim, Targeted Reclaim, EHJJ, and most recently, Competitive Reclaim. So are these cuts across the board to Reclaim or to the more recent Competitive Reclaim?
Across the board, but we will have the ability to decide where the data hits can be absorbed, but it's just Reclaim as a whole.
So that would impact potentially all counties as opposed to.
Absolutely. That's what I'm talking about. The capacity, they no longer can fund a program that's been effective for them. And then the option defaults to us. Where do I put those youth? That's what I'm concerned about.
Any other questions for Director Hare?
Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Gary Moore, Director of Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections.
You know, I think the climate in this room is pretty consistent with what I'm hearing outside, except Tracy, you're more positive maybe. Your outlook's better than $3. Thank you. I didn't hand anything out today, quite frankly, because I didn't know what to present. And this is the first time in 43 years, and actually I've been putting budgets together since 1999 in this system. I'm not sure where we are. And I'll attempt to explain that. And in a term that Sarah, that this group would understand, I think our budget's in a very indeterminate state right now. Let me start with a foundation and try to get us to understand where we are and what our budget, original budget, is built on. And you've heard this 10 times from me probably over the past years, but we take in about 20,000 Ohioans a year. It sounds like we've taken a few less, Tim, if we had the resources with you. But 20,000 Ohioans a year come to prison. 8,300 of those come into us for a year or less. 4,100 are fifth degree felons at their most serious offense. And 3,400 of those have not been convicted of any sex or violence and are not doing mandatory sentences. And that was really what we call our targeted, surgically targeted population. We read a lot, all of us read a lot, and we've read way too much about some of the horrific cases that have taken place in the state, some of which have left our confines and not done well, I might say, and I'll talk about that later. So we attempted in the budget, we actually submitted a budget that said our goal was to look at 3,400 diversions. And the folks in this room, a few folks in this room, Tim, you were there, and a few other folks, they're in recodification meetings early on, Senator Thomas, I'm sorry, Cecil. Spent the first couple days talking about whether a fifth degree felon should be misdemeanors, right? And in fact, in talking to some of the judges and Justice Pfeiffer, et cetera, some of the concerns are that, felonies are rightfully suited to go to prison. So, if you're going to deal with these folks, make them misdemeanors. But there was not an appetite, just quite frankly, there's not an appetite to take that off, or to maybe receive it, is might be the most appropriate question. Yeah. So we said within the confines of the serenity prayer, what do we have control over? What do we have the most control over? I'm finding we have not much. But so we put a following Harvey kind of the model of reclaim, and had we known kind of the where we would be budgetarily, we may have gone a different direction. But we, on the spirit of reclaim, we said, let's take a look at these 3,400 folks that are fifth degree felons, that are doing a year or less, that have not been convicted of sex or violence, are not doing a mandatory sentence. And let's give the counties some money to handle these folks in a way that evidence says works. So instead of coming with some theoretical idea, which it's not, not only based on reclaim, but starting October 1, we have 8 counties. They're not only dealing with felony fives, but 6 of the 8 counties are dealing with nonviolent felony fours and fives, and diverting them with a total sum of 8 that we calculated off the cuff and behind the envelope, but not in any legislation today, $23 a day for a year to handle these 3,400 people. So there's 8 counties, and the 8 counties have undertaken this, and quite frankly, all of them want to continue in this, and many of them have come to testify on behalf of our budget. So we entered the budget season with the targeted community alternatives to prison and an earned credit piece, because as Harvey says, what we know is that GEDs are the number one most significant thing in a person's life, not only to reduce recidivism, but as the University of Cincinnati says, to also reduce violence, and as every one of our evidence-based programs happens to do. So we went in with that and we said, okay, if we target these 3,400 folks and we do half the counties in the first year, fiscal year 18, and encompass the entire state in 19, we can get to our 3,400. And based on that number, we can get to a prison population. This is not speculative. These are actually people that have come to prison, so they're not forecasted numbers. So we build a prison budget on doing what so many other states in the country have done, and that's reduce our prison population, right? By doing the right thing, at least in my mind. So our prison population today stands at 50,200. Now that, I shouldn't say today, that was Tuesday, and it's different today, but 50,200. So we build a prison population based on the diversions and earned credit, that the average prison population in fiscal year 18, if you think of average, since we're going down, we would surgically have to say that our prison population on January 2018, our prison population would need to be at 49,104. This is our budget. And continuing on that with 100% or all the counties participating, our prison population would be at 47,538 as the average count in fiscal year 19 or January 1st of 19. In exchange for that, we put $60 million of new money in those budgets, in our budget, to be able to defer and allow almost total discretion in the counties, and I think the 8 counties that are pilots would attest to that, going from hiring a doctor to handle medication-assisted treatment to negotiating with community residential beds, et cetera, and detox centers, I think, in Medina County. There's a number of things going on. So we entered into the House with that, and there were a lot of changes made. And those changes, as best we can tell, reduced from the 3,400 population down to about 1,200 diversions. And that's the best we can tell. And I anticipate there'll be less than that, because in addition to that, even though the House retained TCAP, it, in addition to reducing the number of diversions, they established a deviation cap of 15% beyond the 3,400. That's one of the reasons we got to it. added a waiver that said that if counties were at 110% of their jail population, there are some provisions to help release that if they so choose, but if not, they could then send a waiver to Cynthia and say, we want to send this population that we're not entitled to the law to DRC, and we are required to accept that. So the 1,200 starts to dissipate, and I think in some counties, if you, we actually have more felony fives locked up than we had before. So I don't know where we are. So we've got the House version that puts us at least $15 million deficit. We have a state budget that has, since we introduced this, has indicated an $800 million deficit. And I think, Senator Thomas, it's fair to say that there's still a gap from the House version to the Senate. So I read in the dispatch a week ago Sunday, you know, there's no one attributing this, but I read in the dispatch that the Senate, Cecil, was looking at $90 million more reduction out of the prison budget. So given those uncertainties, I don't know where we are, but I do know this, and this is the tough piece here. I'm promoting diverting people, and that's going to be my stance, and I've said it's not anything new. Everyone that's known me has known that for 6.5 years, at least since I've been director, because I believe that diverting people in the communities, and not speculative, but allowing the 8 counties they're doing this to testify to their success, starts to alleviate some of the stigma of people coming to prison and starts to reinforce the evidence that handling those individuals in the community. I always tell a story, Cecil, I haven't got to you yet on this, but so I apologize for the legislature, but I tell a story of two tales, right? The first one is, are these fifth degree felon that gets a 6-month sentence. It's got a couple months jail time credit. Hopefully it's calculated right, Tim. Gets to our reception center, goes through reception processing because we have health and mental and educational screening and medical screening and all of those things. And then because our prison population mirrors the density of the state of California when it was under federal order, and thank God we've got medical and mental health practitioners that deliver services better than California did. So you haven't had to defend this on that lawsuit. So they spend a couple months in reception. So they've got 2 months of jail time, 2 months of reception. They finally get to a parent institution, get ready to get into one of the programs that Tracy provides for us. And there's 2 to 3 month wait maybe to get started. There may be a treatment readiness program. But all of a sudden they get out with minimal, if any, dosage of treatment into a community with no supervision. And the county's not even sure they're coming back. That's what happens to about 4,100 people a year in Ohio. And I think what we envisioned is that the other tale would be that we would give adequate resources, particularly, quite frankly, in some rural counties that the state hasn't. We have gone down. Unlike Cuyahoga County, I think, and I would have the numbers right, but it's over $21 million a year out of our budget. Some counties, it's like nothing, small amounts. But to give counties money to, so a judge can take a look at the person a couple times a month if they want to, put them in drug treatment program and for a non-incarceration setting, probably Tracy's going to fund, give more probation services so we have a reduced probation load, maybe put them on electronic monitoring, and maybe even have a judge say every couple of weeks, I want you to come in, show me 3 interviews you've had for a job and promote getting a job, things I can't do. Seems to me to be a better fit. And I know many organizations have not agreed with me on that. So our first preference as we go into the Senate in this kind of very volatile, very tenuous approach is to continue to support diversions, to try to get back to the original piece. Cecil, if you need more money, and we've talked about this, maybe there's some other alternatives that we can have to be able to enhance community dollars and continue to enhance diversions. We've talked about that. There's another alternative,
that got three dissenting votes in the sentencing commission, and that is to just say prisons, prison population is capped at 43,500 men and 3,500 women, so the cap's 47,000. If the prison goes over that, if it goes over that record, under these provisions, release them. I don't want to do that. One, we're not going to give resources to the communities. And two, we're still getting them in prison. They're still affiliating with some people that are not going to be very pro-social in their rehabilitation. But that's going to be voted on. And that was passed with three dissenting votes in the recodification. I don't think that's the best method. But given the fact that we seem to be right now, by necessity, so consumed and so required to look at money because of deficit, we're looking $90 million out of our budget, I think that's something to look at. Now, if we have to, and there's no question, listen, we've already been asked to provide money in this fiscal year to the state. That's a pretty good foreshadowing of what the next biennial budget's going to be. There's no question our budget's going to be reduced. No question. The issue is, are we going to have a reduced population and give the counties and communities more money? Or, and I'm sorry, Lucanne, for all of the cuts going to come out of the community law. Not just eliminating the TCAP, but existing grants. Right? Because I cannot reduce expenditures to my prisons. They are too crowded. They're in jeopardy of litigation. And if you read the papers, you read the papers. So that's where we are, Sarah. I'm sorry, I know you wanted a pristine, crystallized set of numbers. For the first time in my career, I don't have it. We're going to continue to work with the Senate, Cecil. We're going to continue to, and you guys know where I'm coming from. You know my priorities, you know what I believe is right. And I'm standing in a clear minority in that, I see. But I'm still standing. Right, Kim? I'm still standing. Now, the last thing I do want to talk about is, as we look at whatever this shape of pie of this community, however many community dollars is going to be left, I don't know what's going to be. But however many community dollars are left, I hope it's bigger than what we've got now, but I'm worried. I'm very worried. I feel a need to look at risk. I think the taxpayers of the state, I think the judges and people in criminal justice don't expect us to release people that are the highest risk people, homeless. I don't believe you do. But I also believe, and I know, it's happening a lot. So as we look at the existing resources that we have, Cynthia, you and I haven't talked about this much, this is on my mind and my heart, we're going to have to find resources with whatever's left to ensure that the people that pose the highest risk to Ohioans coming out of prison, people that may have served 6 years, people that may have said, I'm not doing any sex offender programming, people that may have been in and out of segregation and hurt people while they're in prison, just not enough to get prosecuted, why wouldn't we expect them to be a higher risk? We're going to have to take resources and ensure that those high-risk people are taken care of in a structured way and not released homeless. Can't happen. So that's also on the radar, and I know some of you pay attention to that as well. So with that, I'll rest with that. Questions? Yes?
I'm not sure if it's a question or not. I appreciate you sharing, Director Moore. I thought I'd share, I'm in Warren County, for those of you that don't know that, I'm the sheriff there, and kind of a small snapshot of what you've described statewide, and we certainly are blessed in the county better than most financially to be able to handle things, but we also, even as a cop for all these years, have have shifted that mindset to try to reduce as many people as you can, you know, getting them out into the, you know, at least electronic monitoring. We've been doing that since 08, and that program began with 400 people, now have over 1,300 people, and of course our jail population has still continued to grow. And again, this is not unlike a lot of communities, but I was glad to hear, as the effort's been to try to push people back out of prison into the local communities, we all know, you know, there still needs to be dollars to handle that flow. And I'm one of probably many in this room that remember when we only had first, second, third degree felonies way back when, and we went to fives, and now it's almost like we're reversing that trend again. So, but like any place else, you know, we're in need of those additional resources that we've kind of outgrown with people in need, and those resources that we've all talked about, you know, drug rehabilitation, mental health concerns. In our jail, we're fortunately, I think, going to have to build a new jail. Nobody likes to see that happen, but I think we're fortunate enough to have the ability to do that. But none of us want to see that happening without those resources continuing to grow to at least try to pull some of these people out with an opportunity. And I certainly appreciate the difficulty that everybody's going through, and I guess just share your equal concern. We're not opposed against you know, that prison population reduction if it will assist, you know, in some way, as long as the communities, I think, are feeling some flow of money's coming back to help, and some of it needed more than others. You kind of identified that.
Let me talk about Warren County just a minute. I was at a breakfast Friday morning, and I'm sitting here, and this is an age issue. I know that it is an age issue. One of the finest judges in Ohio, Peeler, thank you, Judge Peeler. And I don't know if you noticed, I spent a day with you guys down there, a day. And he had, I don't know if you've seen it, he's had his drug testing results. And I don't have it in that form, but he handed it to me. It's the most unbelievable stuff I've ever heard. And he has been a real leader around Ohio with drug courts and diversion and believing in people and having people in there, and it's been great. When we went to the eight counties, we understood that there's a jail issue. We understood that. Right. Now, first of all, let me be clear. I don't believe that a majority of those folks need to be placed and just serve their time in jail. I think a few maybe. And I think maybe many more of them over a short time to teach them a lesson, right? They screw up, they have a positive drug test, you ought to put them in jail right away. I'm sorry, Tim. You ought to do it right away, and then you ought to get them back in a program. Evidence says that Pepperdine has got an unbelievable amount of wealth of data on this. And so we went into the pilot programs, the eight pilot programs, and said, listen, we don't know how you can spend your money almost any way you can, but you can't build something with it. But we said that at any time, this is kind of, we built a model, we want to give everybody more probation services to supervise folks. We want to give people electronic monitoring money. We want to provide some funds for day reporting, whatever other support, your discretion. But we also realize that at any one time, if you have 20 people, and actually this is a good number, 50 counties have 20 people in this cohort or less over the span of a year. 50 counties have 20 people or less. Warren, I guess it's got a little more than that. But probably not huge. That at any one time, for every day in the year, for 365 days, we're going to guess 15% of those are going to be locked up in jail. And we've provided the funds in the pilot project to be able to lock 15 of them up for 365 days, even if they're sentenced to 6 months. And you don't have to, but we started with Tim Ruddick down there in your neighborhood, your part of the state, down in Clinton County. And we require, that's part of the House version that we really like, is that when we sit down and do this, that we got the judges, the prosecutors, the sheriffs, the commissioners in the same room and say, okay, this is the number we're talking about. These are the actual bodies you sent to prison. this is the amount of money that we have to base that diversion on, all of those kind of things. How you guys need to figure out how you want to spend it together. And they came up and Tim Ruddy said, for every person that I put in jail in this cohort, I will pay you fully for their jail time. But then he says, don't expect me to keep them there. And Tim unfortunately reported to the House that he was going to turn money back in that he didn't want to spend it on. So we understand that that's the case. We don't believe, and I think it's been principally stated in an argument that it gets printed, it's hard to argue, isn't it? That if you're diverting 20 people, then you need to provide us, the county's 20 per diems for a year in jail. We don't think that's what evidence says. But we do say that 15%, so we actually calculated that, not that it has to happen, but just as a money number. And in the budget proposal that was originally submitted, there's actually a higher rate per capita of funding in that than we gave the pilot counties. Are all coming back after more. And we have had a substantial number of counties that are interested in participating that sent us letters of interest. I don't know if the Warren counties in there or not, I don't know. But anyway, so I don't know if I've answered that, but I do, you know, one thing about Warren County, you guys are as integrated a county as I've ever seen. From law enforcement to probation to the judicial side, I've not seen, I apologize this, I haven't seen everything, but it is a really good piece of work down there.
I appreciate that comment. I'll just share the last couple things that way we don't drag this out, but you hit on a couple things that we have when you talk about releasing people and the uncomfortableness of just kind of releasing people. We started probably 3 years ago, more aggressively, emergency releasing, you know, lower level people in our facility to allow room for those individuals that needed to be locked up. Because right now, a judge can't lock somebody up like that. Like you'd say, if somebody needed to go, there's generally no room at any given time. And we pretty much adhere to what the standards say. A lot of jails will lay out mattresses and so on and so forth, and we don't do that for liability purposes. We really stay within those standards. If there's no room, then there's no room, and the judges agree with all that. But when all of those partners you described, our collective partners down there, are getting an email on a regular basis that says we released these five people, and here's their charges, and here's their history of charges. It makes people like, oh,
I know.
You know, because, you know, communities are all different, but when you start seeing the types of charges, even though they may be lower risk than others, it makes them cringe, because now they do have some risk involved in the community. So that got a lot of attention of a lot of people that actually, I think, pushed this jail building project forward quicker, because it really just brought everything to everybody's attention, what we're going through. And lastly, there's no sanctions for those 1,300 people that are out trying to do the right thing. And then if they're on their second, third, fourth, or fifth violation of those rules, there's nowhere to put them. So there's got to be some balance somewhere.
I think that part of the balance that we've looked at and that we endorse, quite frankly, from the right, starting at the right number, is a deviation. Let the judge have a deviation. You know, send these same forward if you do up to a certain percent, 15%. And in fact, in a sidebar discussion, we had an option to go up to 25% with a different population. So I think discretion, we've heard that loud, and we think that's a good piece. But let me also say this. There are three counties up there, not huge counties, that are probably going to take TCAP money as a group and just say, find a county that only sent one of these folks to prison last year, and there are some or none, because there's going to be a base. We're going to provide a base for them. That's a good partner to have, because they're going to have a base, but they're looking at a hotel right? To put a certain type of folks in, and they're putting an AA residential model in where they've got some supervision there that they're taking from these funds. But they also have an AA model where they have AA volunteers coming in doing programming, being floor monitors and all those kind of things. A really creative way to use that money to handle a lot of folks that were in need of help and are doing it in a way that it's not singularly county by county, but doing it in a congregate way. So there, it's really a pretty creative way, and it's not the state coming in and saying this is. And you know what? The neat thing is, you don't have any of my auditors out auditing how you're spending your money, right? Unless you build a building, we have to go back and see that. But I mean, that's neat. It's a good thing.
Director, what you started with is what would it make sense put the money in, whatever money you're going to put in, because it sounds like you're not certain how much you're going to have to deal with yet. Put the money in the department and allow you to do what you've done with the pilot so far, and then just tailor the program, because the Northwest program is different than the Dynamo program.
But Medina is consistent with the five counties. Medina and the other five counties are handling both fours and fives.
You put the money in and then let the county, depending on the jail situation, the situation with probation staff, the situation with the county boards, whoever else is providing the services for the county. Tailor three or four different styles to make them.
Well, Justice, and I do apologize for you not getting an invitation down here to the third floor. I read that. I felt terrible about that. But let me just say this. If what we've got to have, we can identify exactly how much money we will have to the communities if we can identify the number of diversions we're going to have, right? And if the diversions, if we can do that, and we can have budget surety, I can't just any longer provide funds out there and have our prison population continue to increase because the money is coming out of the prison side of the budget to give the community. So if we can calculate a way where there's surety with the prison count and population, then I think that's very doable. But since the funds are coming out of the prisons, then we have to have some sense of surety to be able to provide those amounts a month.
Can't you do that for contraction?
We literally are doing that contraction with our pilots, but we have the Woody Hayes thing, back plan, right? Woody Hayes back plan. That was his philosophy. Sarah knows that from years ago. So you start with what you expect to end up with. And what we're saying is, let's identify the numbers of diversions in the prison population, work our way back so we know that, and then which is what we've done with the pilots. We knew that they had, in one county, 25 people in the snowboard. Okay, these are the funds that you've got, and you create a plan. I think it's a lot better than Columbus created a plan. I drive to Columbus from Chillicothe, and I lose intelligence. No, I do, because I'm not close to a prison or a jail. I'm not close to my staff executing policies, not in that office up there. So I really believe that the wealth of intelligence is local, and I'm just trying to provide resources, and I trust the locals. I really do.
The bill that came out of the House required memorandum of understanding.
That's correct.
The judge and the sheriff. But there's no memo of understanding until the department approves. So we're looking at that and going, aren't you really reaching in and telling the judge and the sheriff that they're going to be?
We've never rejected an offer. And the impact, it is, what we want to do is ensure that a sheriff doesn't get cut out of the deal, right? Or one of the other members doesn't get cut out of the deal, or the commissioners, or the partisan. I thought it was more than just those two in that, but you may know that. The goal is to make sure that they have a plan, and we're not, unless they say we're going to build a building, and then that's against the law, we're not overseeing that. We just require that it exists and that the parties agree to it and sign it.
And then we were told that Chris Gallant?
Chris Gallant.
Last week, when probation officers were told to expect a 20% cut in grants next time around. And that just seems counterintuitive to moving people out of prisons to the communities.
What, let me be clear. What Chris was doing was saying, instead of not preparing someone, what we're doing is exactly what I'm doing here today. And that's saying that if we don't achieve the prison population numbers and the cuts that we're in the deep, if we don't do that, then our numbers going to be cut, and as I said here briefly, that the cuts cannot come from the prisons. So what Chris was attempting to do was say, you know, if these numbers continue to go down, if our numbers don't meet what we need to, if the deviations go down, then we're going to have to take the funds from someplace, and it's going to have to be the community. And quite frankly, I appreciate Chris standing up in front of a group and saying, be prepared. I hope it doesn't happen. It doesn't have to happen. But the uncertainties of where we are budgetarily, yeah, we're giving. I'm trying to give people a heads up.
Okay, I wasn't there, but the report we got back was they were told to expect a 20% cut.
Well, Justice, you can convey the fact that the way we're headed right now, I plan on it. I'm an old prison guy. I did contingency planning, right? Yeah. I would plan on it. But let's try to, from my perspective, I'm going to do everything I can to try to avoid that and restore the diversions, and at the same time, maybe even Cecil provide the Senate with a little additional money.
You have 40-some counties that have volunteered for this program right now. Why not base the grant funding pot on the diversion from those 40 counties and let the other 48 counties continue to do as they will?
Let me just say this, and I said this Tuesday. I've been accused of only caring about numbers, publicly and everywhere else. The underpinning of this program was my idea, and it was not my idea to reduce budgets. That was not the underpinning. The underpinning was that if we can keep Ohio communities safer in ways that evidence demonstrates, that ought to make some sense. And there has been a huge disproportionate level of funding in the state in terms of what where we've done. Quite frankly, in the 90s, Sarah, you remember this. In the 90s, based on just self-preservation, we started throwing money at Cuyahoga County that was sending us 24% of our entire prison population. And then we go to other counties, got nothing. So this was an effort to do this. I don't know. You know, all of these things are open, but we have to have surety to be able to identify how many dollars I'm going to have for how many people are going to be in beds in prisons. And I hope that that number is not as high and more money can go to the communities is what I hope. So it's a discussion to go on, and we're working very actively with the Senate right now.
I trust you're open to recalculations still in. We looked, there's like 150 different offenses that are felony crimes. Clearly, some of them should not be felony crimes.
Justice, I think that was a consensus of the RECOD committee, but there is not, to my knowledge, there's not a single recommendation in the RECOD committee to do that for any. Is it Tim? No.
We were told very clearly that it wouldn't be well received.
So there's nothing in the RECOD in that 2,000 pages that does anything.
What do you say to a judge who's got a person who's being convicted of drug trafficking for the fifth time, theft for the fifth time, rape and murder for the fifth time, felony body line, and they can't send that person to prison.
I think they should send them to prison because we'll have a deviation cap. That makes sense. Give judges discretion. That makes a lot of sense to me. And I think that's where we are in the legislative process.
So you think there should be a deviation cap?
I think there is one. And I think that the discussions I've had, we have actually expanded that in a couple of options that we've had in discussions with the Senate. Yeah. I think I've exhausted my question. And myself. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. At this point, we're going to turn to Joellen, and she's going to give us an update on the bail and pretrial services committee report. She has sent out the public comments that we received, both a summary listing as well as the individual comments.
So, as everybody knows, we're planning on voting on the final report of the bail pretrial services report and recommendations at the June meeting. We did have a public comment period open until May 15th. I think through the link on our website, we received about 3 comments about that. We also included it in our comment calculation, a couple of submissions that we had from the bail bondsmen, both the bail bondsmen who were on the committee and then also the professional bail bondsmen of the United States, I think it's UDUS, just to make sure that their concerns were heard. A couple other suggestions had come in earlier to talk about child support and bondsmen child support. So we'll be looking at those. I've sent out a survey to the ad hoc committee members via SurveyMonkey. Just less than ideal, but it would work for this purpose. Listing out the summary, basically asking questions based on the summary of the comments to say, should the report contain this item that was on the comment? So should the report completely, should we recommend the ban of bond schedules, which the report doesn't currently, but that was one of the comments. So once I get the results from that back from the ad hoc committee, I'll take those results, make a determination as to what to include in the final report, and then everyone will receive the final report before the June meeting, so you can read it and vote on it. Unless you have questions.
And the one-page document, as well as all of the public comments received, are on our website, if you want to refer to those.
All right. Sarah's got some final comments, and don't forget, lunches will be served in the next, we hope, 15 minutes or so.
So leave me your $10 if you leave without your lunch. Director Moore, do you have a sense of when you'll be testifying?
Tuesday.
Thank you.
I don't know the time, but it is Tuesday.
And there are some documents on your tables. One is the one pager on the ad hoc bail pretrial services comments. Another is just some historical information on pre-Senate Bill 2, property range and classifications, and post-Senate Bill 2. Because we've heard folks talk about, well, there was no felony 5 before Senate Bill 2, so we put that in just the document to share how it looked before. And the second page is kind of an explanation on how Senate Bill 2 created the felony 5 classification. And then we also took some time, and thanks to the Supreme Court of Ohio Law Library, as well as the Judicial Conference, we took a look at the 50 states' low-level sentencing structures, I guess, for lack of a better word. And so we put those into a complete document that gives you an idea of how other states across the country treat low-level offenders and the sentence lengths. So we looked at those that have prison-eligible sentences of 12 months or less, those that have prison-eligible sentences of 12 months or more for low-level, in quotation mark, offenses. In this document, you don't see Ohio represented, but it will be represented on a document that's online, thanks to some watchful eyes that pointed out we totally forgot our own state. Oh, is it? Oh, they fixed it. Oh, good. They are fast. So anyway, Ohio is in survey now. So it just gives you a sense. We work a lot with other sentencing commissions in states across the country, and people ask us often, so what's the national picture? And we thought this would be helpful to all of you. And it gives the code sections and just some background information. Lou and Marta, thank you again for your support and work on this project. And Aaron. And I think those are my announcements. We do have the full commission meeting in June. And it'll be back in our usual home, so it'll be a little bit more comfortable. Oh yeah, two more things, I guess. So Lisa Hickman is our research specialist. Our last meeting, she was here just because she felt like, oh yeah, I might get this job. Now she's official. She's been with us since April 17th. And we also have an intern from the University of Dayton Civic Scholars Program, Mike Callahan. And interestingly enough, he is working on a national perspective of how other states treat low-level drug offenses. And so you'll see that product at our June meeting. And again, thanks to the Law Library for helping us out and I'm getting started with that project. Now I'm finished.
All right. Well, as we said before, we'll have lunches delivered here in a few moments. We'd encourage you to stick around, and I'm sure any of our speakers would be willing to one-on-one entertain some questions that you may have for them, as well as opportunity for you to connect with some of your other colleagues here. So thank you for appearing. We'll see you in June.